great conference. I'm really excited. The Mises Institute is hosting this conference. I think history and revisionism are so important, especially foreign policy. I'm really excited to talk about my PowerPoint. Thank you, guys. I'm really excited to talk about the Marshall Plan. I have a lot of archival evidence here, so I think this will be some great undercover investigation. Okay, so let's jump in. What was the Marshall Plan? The Marshall Plan, if you've heard anything about it, you know that it was this giant piece of foreign aid that was in the public interest. It saved the world, and it was just a great instance of America really rising to the world stage and saying, hey, we're a world superpower. The Foreign Assistance Act of April 1948, also known as the Marshall Plan, authorized up to $17 billion of aid to Western Europe. And very important, as I'm going to discuss today, it authorized up to $500 million in aid to China and to nationalist China. And we're told that this important piece of legislation was in the public interest. Without the Marshall Plan, the communists would have taken over. They would have conquered, the Soviets would have conquered Europe. They would have conquered all of Asia. I think a far more accurate description of the Marshall Plan comes from the Chicago Tribune. Right, this fiery old right newspaper from back in the day, and they called it the Marshall Plan slush fund. According to the Chicago Tribune, quote, "There was never a bigger slush fund than the Marshall Plan, and there was never a more brazen appeal to corruption than was made on behalf of the plan." And this mirrors what Tom DiLorenzo wrote in the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed that I really liked. Quote, "The main purpose of the Marshall Plan was to provide a veiled form of corporate welfare for American businesses." And that's exactly what I want to argue. And I want to go through a very important case study that I think not too many people know about. Okay, so let's jump in. I want to explain that the Marshall Plan is cronyism, so it didn't benefit the public. And instead, it just benefited various special interests. Well, if we didn't have the Marshall Plan, Europe would have laid in ruins, especially Germany. Right, so let's focus on Europe for a little bit. Europe was in crisis after the war. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they got totally destroyed. People were going hungry. The private sector had basically collapsed. This was especially true in post-war Germany, which was divided up into four economic zones. You had the British economic zone, you had the French economic zone, you had the American economic zone, and of course, you had the Soviet economic zone. The three zones. To the left, the green, yellow, and blue, of course, in 1949, they became West Germany, the red, East Germany, right? The reason why Germany was struggling so much was not the free market or anything like it. It was because there wasn't a return to the free market. We were continuing all of the Nazis' economic controls, all of the Nazi socialism, price controls, production controls, rent controls, conscription of labor, high taxes, goods were rationed, people didn't have an incentive to produce. And it was actually the so-called German ordo-liberals, these free market economists and public intellectuals that were allied with Mises and Hayek, they saved Germany, right? In particular, it occurred in the British American zones because they abandoned wartime socialism. And this was done by director of the Economic Administration, Ludwig Erhard, right? Who was really with the stroke of a pen able to abolish price controls on household items, agricultural machinery, and other goods. And this really got West Germany, or what became West Germany, back on its feet, right? Because people now had an incentive to produce, right? It wasn't the Marshall Plan, because Marshall Plan money was given to other countries like Great Britain and France and Austria, and recovery was much weaker there. And that's because they continued wartime socialism. So for anyone interested in the Marshall Plan in Europe, look at the German ordo-liberals. And you should also read Henry Hazlitt's great book that came out in 1947, Will Dollars Save the World?, which is a critique of the imminent Marshall Plan. Okay, so what about China? Most people don't know anything about China and the Marshall Plan, but this is actually what I want to spend a significant amount of my talk on, because this is really the neglected part of the Marshall Plan. And I think so much of our post-World War II policy relating to China is still with us in certain respects. The Chinese economy was undeniably in ruins, okay? There was a war with Japan, where Japan had conquered most of a large part of China, and they had ravaged the economy. after 1945, the war with Japan was over, but the Chinese Civil War had resumed. And the Chinese Civil War was a on-again, off-again conflict that had started in 1927 between the nationalists led by Chiang Kai-shek and the communists led by Mao Zedong, right? So we have a map here of China. This is about 1946. The red is was controlled by the communists. They were based out of Beijing. The blue is controlled by the nationalists. They were based out of Nanking in the south, close to Shanghai. And China had been a huge focus of the United States because we wanted to export goods to China, and we also wanted to Christianize China. So we had really prioritized China, and we had worked with the nationalists. Post-World War II, the United States provided the nationalists $2.25 billion in aid. That might not sound like a lot because of inflation, but adjusted for inflation, it's quite a lot. This was more than 50% of the expenditures of the Chinese government, which was proportionally greater than any Western European country that we gave aid to. So we really tried to back the Chinese nationalists to the hilt. Okay, the problem was that the nationalists were incredibly corrupt. That was their biggest problem, and that was by far Mao Zedong's biggest asset. Because there's no better way to rally impoverished peasants in the countryside by telling them that their rulers are corrupt capitalists that are exploiting them. Right? They got one part right. They were corrupt. The capitalist part, less so, right? but they had monopoly companies siphon off foreign aid from the United States. The Universal Trading Company was based in New York City. They would be given funds from Congress, and then they would be used to buy all sorts of military equipment and supplies, but then not all of it went to China. Or not all of it went to the people. It was sold on the black market. The Chiang regime was basically profiting off of this. We had lent them gold. They had turned around and they had used the gold for speculation and all sorts of stuff. Harry Truman considered them grafters and crooks. Okay, he famously said that they're grafters and crooks and they're thieves and they stole $750 million from us. Right. Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau said that giving money to them was like putting money down a rat hole. All right, so he was the Secretary of the Treasury for FDR and for Truman at the beginning. And I mean, if he's saying something's a rat hole, then I mean, you got to really think it must have really been a rat hole. And the amount of money that we had given to the Chiang regime, and it had just they had always asked for money, then they turned around and they just spent it in the State Department in the United States as well as in Great Britain. We had a nickname for Chiang Kai-shek. He was known as Cash My Check. Right, and that had stuck. He was cash my check because he would just simply take our money and then move and run with it. I'm not gonna lie, that's actually a really catchy nickname, cash my check. So who did the Marshall Plan benefit? It didn't benefit Europe. It didn't benefit China. But who it did benefit was it benefited United States corporations, right? And this is why the Chicago Tribune and through so many articles called it gravy or slush fund or things like that. How did it benefit corporations? Well, the United States provided taxpayer funds to Europe, okay, for those countries to spend on United States exports, right? That's clearly a transfer program. It's a subsidy, right? And so one of the biggest beneficiaries of this plan, I could go through a lot of case studies, but I want to talk about this case study, was the man who brainstormed the Marshall Plan. It wasn't George Marshall, George C. Marshall, the famous general. I am talking about Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, William L. Clayton. How many of you have heard of William L. Clayton before? A couple of you probably haven't, but you should, right? You should know about him. And here he is in front of his office, right? Okay, so who was Will Clayton? He was the owner of a Texas-based cotton brokerage firm turned international statesman. Anderson Clayton and Company was involved in buying and selling cotton around the world. This is what he had done in the 1920s and 1930s. He had joined the government in 1941, served in various capacities during the war, and then he had joined the State Department in December 1944 as an assistant secretary of state turned undersecretary of state. And he left shortly after the Marshall Plan was created. So Clayton, according to the New York Times, was an embodiment of American economic power, right? His true representation of the so-called Eastern establishment. This is a rare picture I found in a cotton journal where someone told him it would be a good idea to sort of hunch over a globe looking kind of menacingly. So I looked at this and I said, oh my God, this man's a globalist, right? But to Clayton was responsible for so much of our post-war World War II economic policy. To his credit, he was a big proponent of free trade. And he, more than anyone else, was responsible for the general agreement on tariffs and trade in the post-World War II lowering of tariff barriers, right? So he should be applauded for this. But he also was a big proponent of foreign loans and foreign aid to countries so they could turn around and they could buy products from us, like cotton, right? As we will see, okay? So during his Senate confirmation hearing in 1944, he was asked about his relationship with the Anderson Clayton Company. He'd been chairman of the board. It was a private company before it turned corporate. It went corporate or public in 1945. He was asked about this. He said, my family and I own approximately 40% of the company. Him and his wife and his four daughters, he had spread his wealth out among his family. And he said, my only connection with the company is as a stockholder. He was a passive basically recipient of dividends at this point. His full focus was on the public interest in promoting America and helping countries around the world. Looking through his letters and his correspondence, that's a lie. It's honestly a lie. He was still heavily involved with his company, corresponding with the company president, Lamar Fleming Jr. He was involved in the company's decision to go public. Lamar Fleming would talk to him about who to appoint to various vice presidential positions within the company. Clayton advised his company on when to sell inventory based on government policy regarding cotton. And as we'll see, he also steered several, made sure they could get some lucrative contracts in the cotton business. All right. So contemporaries, they've discussed Clayton's involvement in European affairs, right? They say, well, Clayton did so much. He drafted the Marshall Plan. He was involved in stuff. They have completely neglected his connections to the nationalist regime, right? So the people in the past, they recognized that Clayton was doing all this stuff. And they didn't mention anything about China. And historians still do this. Historian Priscilla Roberts, who I have an enormous respect for her work on 1920s monetary policy, said, quote, during his years in government, Clayton had virtually no hand in the making of U.S. policy towards China. And that's not true. He had a significant involvement with China, right? And this is something that the Chicago Tribune also got wrong, right? So Clayton was friends with T.V. Sung. Has anyone heard of T.V. Sung before? A couple of people. He was the brother-in-law of Chiang Kai-shek, right? So he was involved in various financial positions in the nationalist China government. His sister had married Chiang Kai-shek, so that's a pretty big step up to power. He was enormously wealthy. He is reputed to have been one of the richest men in the world, probably because of all the money he took from the United States. But Clayton was close with him. Song had used his power to become extremely wealthy. He set up China Textiles Development Company, which was basically a company that monopolized all cotton imports. And then they would make various articles of clothing and other stuff. All right. So who do you think he bought the cotton from? Right. Here's a letter from Song to Clayton. And he's basically saying, I have friends like you to support me. This is in June 1945. He's thanking Clayton for all he's done. Again, thank you for all you've done for my country and myself personally. Over the past couple of months, Clayton had been involved in making sure that gold would continue to be sent to China. Gold that, well, coincidentally, could be used to buy cotton. Coincidentally, from Clayton. All right? Here's a letter from Clayton to Lamar Fleming. He's basically telling Fleming that he encouraged Song to buy cotton from the United States. Strange to say, Song hadn't given much thought to it until I mentioned it to him. Clearly, it has huge influence on policy. He's telling the head of their finances to buy cotton from the United States. And then what is he saying? You should be able to do a lot of business there in the next few years, right? He's writing that to his old president, right? His colleague or his president. He's basically saying you guys can make a lot of money. All right, and how much are we talking about? This is from a Shanghai trade journal. Listing the biggest importer, the biggest sellers of cotton to China from 1945 to 1949, right? Who's at the top? Anderson Clayton Company. They shipped 28% of the cotton to China, that China imported. Does anyone know who's number two? UNRRA United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration at 27%. This man's company shipped more cotton to China than the United Nations. Right? That's that's actually quite incredible, right? That just shows you how much his company was involved in China. And of course, he was very involved in China, right? So we could talk about all sorts of stuff that Clayton did and with China and even with Europe and all sorts of things like that. He was involved in several export-import bank loans for countries to buy China, to buy cotton, excuse me, including China. I want to skip ahead to the Marshall Plan. In March of 1947, Truman famously advocated aid to Greece and Turkey, right, as a way of sort of trying to stop communism and all this stuff. And here's a letter from Fleming to Clayton basically talking about this. So Fleming says, as it relates to our business, I feel that the new developments should be generally helpful, right? Because we're going to give money to countries to buy goods from the United States. If they want to beef up their militaries, well, you got to have all the soldiers wear uniforms. And what are the uniforms going to be made of? It's going to be made of cotton, right? So he's saying it should be generally helpful. And he says, I feel they are even more important as to Spain and China. Spain was still fascist. Spain was not a recipient of Marshall Plan money, but Clayton was also involved. Anderson Clayton Company was involved in selling cotton to Spain. And of course, they were involved in selling cotton to China, as we will see. So Clayton develops the Marshall Plan a couple months later. This is from the Clayton archives, and you can see the archivist note. It's essentially a rough draft of the Marshall Plan. And this is something that's not disputed by historians. Everyone says Clayton developed the Marshall Plan. He said that, look, Europe's economy is in shambles. We got to give them money so then they can buy stuff from America, right? It really should be called the Clayton Plan, but they called it the Marshall Plan because it's obviously he was the Secretary of State, and you get this, you get a famous World War II general. How could Congress not pass a plan named after him, right? All right, so this is fairly readily admitted. What isn't really known is that Clayton was involved in making sure China was included in the plan. June 11th, 1947, Clayton was at a State Department meeting, and what did he say? Mr. Clayton offered the suggestion that we consider approach to Congress for such funds as may prove necessary for the general financial assistance of China. They could buy all sorts of goods. They could buy cotton, right, and so on. What happened a week later? Well, China's ambassador, Dr. V.K. Wellington Koo, had come to the United States saying, well, the Marshall Plan needs to be extended to China. And who did he meet with? At the State Department for more than an hour, Undersecretary of State Will Clayton, right? So this alone shows you that clearly this man had some influence with regarding our policy to China. I mean, that can't even really be disputed. What did they talk about? Did they talk about the baseball game or something? Probably not. They spoke about the specifics, and they spoke about, okay, maybe his company was brought up, right? We don't know. But we do know who China purchased cotton from using Marshall Plan money. Okay, so before I get into that, so in late 1947, Clayton did resign as Undersecretary of State. He did not leave the State Department, though. He was a special advisor to the State Department. He still had a building in the State Department, and he hadn't gone back to his company. He kind of had one foot out the door. And he spent all of the rest of 1947 and 1948 advocating for the Marshall Plan. Well, we need the Marshall Plan to save Europe. We need the Marshall Plan to save to save the world and so on, right? So then this takes us to April 1948. Congress passes the Marshall Plan then. Title IV, right? It's never the first or the second title where the biggest cronyism is. It's sometimes buried, right, deep down. Title IV was the China Aid Act, where we had authorized up to $500 million in military and economic aid to the nationalists in China. The Civil War wasn't going well for them. They were losing ground to the communists, but we didn't want to give up on them because if we said, well, if we give up on nationalist China, what type of sign will that send or signal will that send to Europe, right? Are we going to give up on our allies, right? And I'm sure we've all heard of that before where we say, well, you know, giving money to this group isn't good, but well, we got to keep giving money to them because what will that send, you know, then other groups, are we not going to help them out at all? You know, so stuck in the trap, so to speak. Okay, so in late October, the Chicago Tribune reports that Anderson, Clayton, and Company received about $28 million of Marshall Plan funds, right, to buy cotton. This is right before the election, right, the presidential election in November of 1948, when Harry Truman unexpectedly won. And the Chicago Tribune had a great sort of a great expose. The problem was they had thought that Anderson, Clayton, and Company made most of its sales, right, that $28 million came largely from aid given to Europe, when in reality, it was aid given to China. Here is a confidential, basically a business sheet sent from Lamar Fleming to Clayton. It's open risks outside of the Western Hemisphere, all countries. All the way at the bottom is China, $25 million, right? So out of that $28 million, China, about $25 million of it came from China, right? The Chicago Tribune didn't really recognize this, right? But Anderson, Clayton & Company, they made an enormous amount of money from the Marshall Plan, not from selling cotton to Europe, but by selling cotton to China. The story didn't really gain much traction. It would, you know, the Chicago Tribune kept talking about it. The problem was Harry Truman had unexpectedly won the presidential election in 1948, and the Chicago Tribune had made a big mistake by printing a newspaper showing the early results of the election where they said Dewey defeats Truman, right? And that was a big, big sort of snafu for the Chicago Tribune. Okay, so where does this take us? How much did Anderson and Clayton and company earn from the Marshall Plan? This is something I've been trying to figure out. Unfortunately, the government's, it's hard to track down some of this data. Some of it's not available in the National Archives anymore. They've gotten rid of it, unfortunately. But there have been some congressional reports on this. In 1948 alone, Anderson, Clayton, and Company received about $33 million of Marshall Plan money. Okay, so from April to December 1948. About $26 million came from China. So a large part of it was that lump sum purchase from the nationalist regime in July and August. And about $7 million came from Europe, right? So clearly we can see that they made a lot more of their money by selling cotton to China than to Europe. Altogether, this is about 29% of the total Marshall Plan cotton exports for the year. And this was more than the company's normal 17% share of total U.S. cotton exports. Right, so it wasn't just an excuse often given, which they said, well, Anderson, Clayton Company, they got these sales because they were the largest cotton firm. Of course they're going to get these sales. But in reality, they got a much bigger share of the market than what they normally get. Okay, so clearly Anderson, Clayton Company benefited, we could say, from the Marshall Plan. Now, what about our friend William Clayton? Right, how much did he benefit from? Right, how much did he benefit from his time in the State Department? He was in the State Department from December 1944 to November 1948, right? The good news is that Clayton kept his balance sheets, right? And that was sort of a gem to look at. So kept his balance sheets. All right, so in December 1944, his personal net worth, not including his wife's net worth and his four daughters' net worth, because he had spread out his ownership of his company throughout his family, it was about $4 million, okay? All right, well, fast forward a couple years. September 1948, he's worth about $12 million. All right, these are actual photos of him. I just thought they were so great for this. consumer prices had risen by about 40% in the post-World War II era, so that obviously took a chunk out. But when you adjust for inflation, that's still 120% gain. Over 4 years? That's incredible. While he's serving in the State Department, right? And he's steering contracts to his own company. I mean, I'm actually surprised, really, this is it's remained hidden for as long as it has, right? But the man who designed the Marshall Plan was the man who basically benefited from it, right? This clear cronyism going on, okay? So the Chicago Tribune wrote that a slush fund was never before given so exalted a moral tone, and never before was the take as big as it is going to be this time, right? It was a slush fund, as they had pointed out. It didn't help Europe, right? Europe, the parts of Europe that did recover really recovered from deregulation, not from foreign aid. And it certainly didn't benefit nationalist China. The communists took over. The nationalists kept losing battle after battle. In 1949, Chiang Kai-shek accused Song of corruption, right? So Song fled China to New York. Chiang had famously fled mainland China to Taiwan to set up the government we now know as the Republic of China, okay? And Song didn't return to Taiwan until like 1963. He was so worried about Chiang Kai-shek, right? But the communists took over. They had captured about $12 million of cotton in Shanghai, as well as all sorts of military equipment we had given to the nationalists, and that clearly strengthened their ability to oppress their own citizenry, right? But what does remain, and I want to end with this, is this great letter in early 1949 from Clayton to Song and his wife. And he's saying, well, I'm really sorry to hear about all that's happened. But we've sold a great deal of cotton to China, for which we're very grateful, right? He's writing back at his own company. He's back as chairman of the board of Anderson Clayton Company. He's like, you know what? I'm sorry about everything that's happened, but, you know, we made a lot of money. So it worked out for us, right? So I think I will end there. And thank you so much for your attention.